IEEE Soundings examines the human voice and the computer.
The human voice, a familiar sound, but in this case sounded not by a human larynx, but by use of an electronic artificial larynx. Our special guest, Dr. J.L. Flanagan, who is head of Bell Laboratories Acoustics Research Department, will participate with us later using his natural voice. Soundings in this issue looks at and listens to the state of the art in representation of the human voice. We've chosen this somewhat specialized field because it's one which our own audio medium can uniquely demonstrate. What does true synthetic speech sound like? Here's a sample, synthesized from English text by Dr. C.H. Coker and his colleagues at Bell.
I am a computer. I can read stories and speak them aloud. I do not understand what the words mean when I read them, but I can guess which words are important and which words are not by rules I have been given. Someday, I may be able to provide many kinds of information by telephone.
Throughout this soundings tape, we'll hear artificial speech synthesized in various laboratories using various techniques. We invite you to compare speech quality, but caution that the intent of each synthesis is different. Some experimenters are attempting to produce a highly natural quality, while others are more concerned with efficiency of storage of the coded speech information, and still others with the requirement for minimum hardware to convert from printed English to recognizable audio speech patterns. These different goals are attacked in different manners. Although this tape deals primarily with speech synthesis, later we'll examine with Jim Flanagan several of the applications of speech analysis. That is, the problem of determining from a spoken record either who said it or what it was he said. When attacking the problems of synthesizing human speech, we might, as a first approximation, view speech simply as a set of words recited one after another. After all, words are the basic building blocks of a written or spoken language, and children learning to read often use exactly the word-after-word style. But effective speaking requires varying stress, pauses, and changes in pitch, which tie the separate words into phrases with particular meanings. Phrases build into sentences, sentences into paragraphs, and even larger units. Stress and the use of pauses in our everyday speech reflects familiarity with word usage, which in the case of college lectures can continue developing and changing throughout an entire semester. For example, the first time a professor mentions a technical term to his class, he may pause and accentuate it. Later, as it becomes more familiar to the listener, it receives less distinction. At present, the synthesis of speech generally falls into two categories. In the first, the messages which must be produced are composed of a limited number of words, which must be rearranged in order. This type of application is exemplified by the voice answerback system. For example, a system to redirect calls for disconnected telephones. We'll hear remarks from Bill Chapman of IBM and from Larry Rabiner of Bell Laboratories related to this type of application. In other applications, the variability of the messages required is so great that it will be necessary to form the words themselves from pieces which can be put together. And here, of course, the long-term effects in the speech patterns become more important. Professor Jonathan Allen of MIT is attacking the problem of synthesizing lengthy messages using printed English text as a source. Here he explains some problems imposed by the language itself and describes a system whereby the complete job can be carried out.
The goal that I want to discuss today is how to synthesize speech from any English text that might be presented to you. Now, if you were presented with this problem from the start, certainly what you'd like to do is to be able to start with the letters and go directly to groupings of sounds. We'll see, as the talk goes on, that there's a lot of structure in words, and of course in sentences too, which simply cannot be ignored. In other words, it's not going to be possible to go directly from letter strings to words without understanding the fact that these aren't just letter strings, but they're actually linguistic units in the language. The word cats in a written representation, what we might like to do is go directly from those four letters to the string of four phonemes, we'll see that a better way of doing it, and one that's quite economical, is to first recognize that cats is made up of cat plus the plural morpheme, in this case S, and that once we know that, then we'll be able to synthesize the whole word as one unit. In order to appreciate the fact that words and their morphs, or as we call them, these chunks of words, must be recognized, let's try to see what happens if we look directly at some of the letter-to-sound correspondences. Two of the more miserable ones in English. The first one is EA. We have create, search, meet, heart, leather, stake, meander. But we also have words like react and changeable. And notice that you can draw a line right between the E and the A in both of those two cases because those words are made up of discernible chunks. O-U-G-H is even worse. You have plow, though, bought, cough, rough, through, and hiccup. So clearly there is a one-many mapping going on here, and we've got to bring bigger guns to bear on this problem. However, all is not completely chaos. It may appear to be so, but it's the fact that words that have been around for a long time that sometimes leads to this chaos. We know, for instance, that F is almost completely regular in English. It always has the F sound, as in fun and roof. But in of, it has the sound of V. It's voiced. Have is another good example. We have shave with exactly the same letter string in it. We even have behave. But have holds out for having a different pronunciation. Also, high-frequency words in the language with initial TH almost always have them voiced, like in they, there, and that. But less frequent words have thesis, thimble, and, of course, in final position, earth. And we see another example of what happens with was as opposed to atlas and canvas, exactly the same final AS string. Still, other troubles arise, however, because of the fact that there are these boundaries inside of words which split up words into these linguistic units, which are very real things. You might be tempted to try to pick out clusters of letters and convert them, but it really won't work unless you recognize the internal structure. For instance, in SCH, we have school and scheme. That seems quite nice. But then we have mischance and discharge. And for awe, we have law and awful, but then awake and awash. And TH, we have thigh and thirst, but then hothouse. Clearly, in each of these cases, that cluster is broken up by the internal structure of the word. And we've got to get at that internal structure if we're ever going to have any chance of converting the word to appropriate speech. Now, after an overall scheme, which I think holds the promise of being able to take arbitrary English text as input and convert it to speech. We start with text. Let's assume that we have it in machine-readable form. I won't deal with a character recognition problem. And what we try to do is decompose words into a dictionary in a process that I'll talk a little more about. That is, we'd like to know that changeable is made up of change plus able, or able as the case may be. If that fails, then we try to use letter sound rules. And one of my theses is that letter sound rules, while you've seen horrible evidence of how they break down in the high frequency words of the language, and for low frequency words, they actually work out quite nicely. So by one of these two methods, then, we derive what the actual sound symbols are. Then we do a syntactic analysis, and then from that point on, we've completed the linguistic analysis. If you like, we've done all the analysis work to find that abstract linguistic structure. And from that point on, we can use phonemic and prosodic rules. Prosodic may be a new word so far in this talk. It means those rules which apply over more than one sound unit. And then finally, all of that information must be fed to a vocal tract model, which produces the output speech. Let's talk next a little bit about some of the parts of this system, namely the word decomposition work, which is one of the parts that's received the most attention in the work that I've been doing. In fact, words are composed of parts, and this is a very frequent phenomenon in English. We have two things going on. Light can have all sorts of things tacked onto it in order to form different words, and it certainly would be nice if we didn't have to store light every time for all of those words. We see prefixes and suffixes and even another word tacked on the front to form starlight. Such words are called compounds. So we have prefixes, suffixes, and roots. There are other kinds of roots, which I call functional roots, which also are very handy, but don't exist alone. One of these is ception. We can have reception, inception, deception, perception, conception, and even contraception. And then we can even have things going on the beginning and end of these functional roots. We can have discriminate, recrimination, incriminate, and you can try all the combinations, and you'll see that not all of them work. But since we're faced with input text, this is not it's not used in a generative rule, so we don't have any problem of generating combinations that aren't actually words. Knowing about all of these constituents of words, the next problem is, given an input word, how can we possibly find out which of these roots and prefixes and suffixes are represented in that word? So we try to use a decomposition process. And this process is reasonably involved. It has to be able to cope with words like diner, which is dine plus ER, but if you represent it as those two components, there's an extra E in there, so it's got to know about that. It's got to worry about consonant doubling, like in the word hopping. And it's got to worry about changing Y to I, as you all learned in school, like in city plus S goes to cities. The only problem that we get into in this process is occasionally we get more decompositions than we'd really like to see. In the case of scarcity, we'd like to get scarce plus itty, but we even get scar city directly. In the case of rumbled, we get rumble plus ED, but also rum plus bled, which has interesting semantic possibilities. And in the case of endear, we get N plus deer and end plus ear. Resting, resting plus the other choice is re-sting. Well, when we first discovered this was a little bit of a problem, as you can imagine. So we had to start looking for ways to get rid of the ones we didn't want, some argument about which ones we wanted. But one of the things that we found out was that a very simple set of selectional rules, which seemed to be very general for English, suffice to select the right one. For instance, it turns out in English that given an ambiguous situation, such as is represented in all of these, the language will always prefer to see an affix rather than another word tacked on. So rather than seeing two roots together, it would prefer to see one root plus an affix. So by means of these selectional rules, we've been able to get all possible decompositions in terms of our dictionary and then pick the right one by actually a very simple set of rules. Now, if we do decompose a word, then the dictionary provides the proper sound symbols. But if decomposition fails, then we have to use letter sound rules. Now, the game we're playing here is that the high-frequency words are going to be already in the dictionary. You'd like to have them there anyways. And that's where the exceptions to the letter sound rules lie. So those words are the exceptions, the ones that will not work by letter sound rules, are already in the dictionary. Now, this is all very nice, but we've got to have a dictionary that will give us some confidence that we can carry on this process. First of all, we started with a base lexicon. Now, this includes what linguists call the closed word classes, that is, articles, prepositions, conjunctions, pronouns, auxiliaries, and modals. Our prefixes and suffixes obviously have to be in there, as well as the functional roots, and all of those high-frequency words and exceptions that would raise havoc with any letter sound rules. Then we looked for the largest and most recent representative sampling of English text that we could find, and the corpus is called the Brown Corpus because it was collected at Brown University. And from a million word tokens, there turned out to be, in the sample that was taken, some 40,000 separate words. So we sorted this first by length, shortest word first, and then within each length by frequency. And then what we did is just took each word and, starting from the top of this or beginning of this sorted list, and tried to decompose it into our growing dictionary. And if the decomposition worked and was acceptable on grounds of pronunciation and parts of speech implications, then we would accept it and also chalk up frequency counts for those root words or prefixes or suffixes that are already in the dictionary. If not, we would put the whole word in. And so in this way, we're able to build up a dictionary which would have very large generative power over the language. Getting back to the process of generating speech now, the next step that we have to deal with is parsing. Now, parsing certainly is an essential thing. We have many noun-verb ambiguities in English which are reflected in their pronunciation, like the difference between convert and convert, both spelled the same. So we need parsing for stress information, certainly for intonation information, and for generating pauses. What we have done is to build a rather small parser, but one which is designed to handle a very large number of constructions. Runs very fast, but it only gives one possible parsing. That's one of the reasons it can run fast. The grounds for that are that even though English is notoriously syntactically ambiguous, only one parsing will do because presumably you're only going to put out one utterance. Nevertheless, this whole parsing scheme runs in about 3K of core and also within the constraint that the entire system can run in real time. Well, at this point, we've done all the analysis. In other words, we've inferred the linguistic abstract structure. We found out what it is we're going to synthesize. The remaining problem is how are we going to say it? We now have to go ahead and actually find out those control parameters which are going to control the vocal tract model. So far in the work that I'm describing here, we have not developed extensive rules for pitch control, but we've done a fair bit on working out vowel durations and consonant durations as a function of both the context, the number of syllables, and the syntactic role in the word. Rules for pauses and other effects are also used, too. And more recently, I've been collaborating with Dr. Dennis Clatt at MIT in using a set of rules for phonemic synthesis, which all of this process up to this point is directed towards. There's a fairly elaborate vocal tract model which is used, and all of this information which has been derived up to this point is then fed to this vocal tract model, and synthesis by rule is then carried out. The end result of this whole process is speech, which in time we hope to be both intelligible and natural. You might say that what we're trying to capture in this overall process is just that competence that a native speaker has when he reads aloud. You might think, for instance, that when you read along, certainly most of us do whole word recognition, and a system like this tries to do the same. If we don't recognize the whole word, we look to see if there are any chunks in the word that we know. And if that fails, then we sound it out, just as I believe you and I would when we run into a word that's completely unfamiliar. I'd like to play three sentences that we've recently synthesized. I'd like to emphasize that these are done completely by rule, but without all the rules that we'd like to see there. There is some pitch modulation, but it's not a function of stress. It's done by a very simple-minded rule, and there is no appreciable change in pitch as a function of the content of the sentence.
This paper presents a method for synthesizing speech from text.
Example of a short sentence. This paper presents a method of synthesizing speech for text. Notice that presents, for instance, is a noun-verb ambiguity. We don't want to say this paper presents. We want to say this paper presents. The next sentence is actually two sentences and quite long. It shows incidentally, the difficulties that I think exist today in keeping up with involved structures with today's level of synthesis.
Because this technique uses both a dictionary and letter-to-sound rules, it can convert unrestricted text to speech.
And then finally, one sentence in which there are quite elaborate use of compounds.
Information retrieval systems and reading machines for the blind are some of the applications for this process.
English is certainly a difficult language, particularly for machines, to understand. Another laboratory which is interested in this type of speech synthesis is Haskins Laboratories. Haskins' Dr. F.S. Cooper has specific applications for speech synthesis from printed material, which he will explain to us.
Our primary interest in speech is to learn how people make it, and particularly, how they understand it. This is very basic research, and we have used speech synthesis as one of our major research tools. In addition, we have worked for some long time on the practical problem of building a high-performance reading machine for the blind. Now, this is a topic in its own right, and here I will say only that if a blind man is to have easy, rapid access to the same books that most people use, he will need a device that can talk plain English at normal or even very rapid rates. So we have focused on getting intelligible and fairly rapid speech from the information that one finds on a printed page. The whole process requires optical character recognition, followed by conversion of the conventional spelling to phonetic spelling, and this in turn by automatic generation of the speech. Most of our efforts thus far have gone into what we think is a major bottleneck, namely the conversion from phonetic transcription to spoken sound. There are only a few basic methods, but many, many variants, and that the choice of method is heavily influenced by the intended application. As for the reading machine problem, it is one of the most demanding of applications, because it is so completely open-ended in both vocabulary and sentence structure. I think it's hard to realize, unless you have worked with speech, how much difference it makes, depending on whether you have a fixed frame or whether you're working into an open-ended system.
He has sent us some demonstration tapes, which he now describes the preparation of.
The first was the familiar fable of the North Wind and the Sun. It was generated by computer from a phonetic type-in. The phonetic information was used to compute, by rule, the parameters that control a formant-type synthesizer. The rate of speaking goes up from about 130 words per minute at the beginning to about 220 words per minute at the end of the story. Perhaps I should stress that the only information given to the computer was the phonetic spellings of the words of the story, the phrase endings, and the sentence stress. Everything else was automatic.
The North Wind and the Sun were arguing one day about which of them was the stronger, when the traveler came along wrapped in a warm coat. They agreed that the one who could make the traveler take his coat off would be considered stronger than the other one. Then the North Wind blew as hard as he could, but the harder he blew, the tighter the traveler wrapped his coat around him, and at last the North Wind gave up trying. Then the sun began to shine hotly, and the traveler took off his coat immediately. And so the North Wind was obliged to confess that the sun was the stronger of the two.
We wondered how much would be lost if all the steps in the process were automatic. And that is what the next recording is about. We used a human being to simulate some of the hardware and programs, but his job was to carry out the operations strictly by the book. For the phonetic transcription, he looked up the printed words in a pronouncing dictionary. For juncture and stress assignments, we had the help of Noriko Yumeda and an algorithm she had developed. For all the remaining steps, the computer took over, using Mattingly's rules for synthesis, just as it did for the North Wind and the Sun. Thus, the next recording should be fairly representative of what can be done by methods that are completely automated.
Some early research in animal communication by Mark Twain. Animals talk to each other, of course. There can be no question about that. But I suppose there are very few people who can understand them. I never knew but one man who could. I knew he could, however, because he told me so himself. He was a middle-aged, simple-hearted miner who had lived in a lonely corner of California among the woods and mountains a good many years and had studied the ways of his lonely neighbors, the beasts and the birds, until he believed he could accurately translate any remark which they made. This was Jim Baker. According to Jim Baker, the blue jays were the best talkers he had found among the birds and beasts. Said he, there's more to a blue jay than any other creature. Whatever a blue jay feels, he can put it into language. And no mere commonplace language, either. And as for command of language, why you never see a Bodhi get stuck for a word.
These recordings were made a year or so ago. They are not very different from the recordings we are currently making for use in field trials with students and blind veterans. Here is the first half minute or so of one of the recordings that we are using in these field trials, and that was made quite recently using synthesis by rule methods.
You will now hear a few pages from Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie. When I was very young, and the urge to be someplace was upon me, I was assured by mature people that maturity would cure this itch. When years described me as mature, the remedy prescribed was middle age. In middle age, I was assured that great age would calm my fever, and now that I am 58, perhaps senility will do the job. Nothing has worked.
In conclusion, computers really can talk, and those of us who are working on the problem are convinced that they will learn to talk even better and more naturally than they do now. You will probably have guessed that we at Haskins think that synthesis by rule is the most promising of the various methods, at least for the long term and for those applications that require versatility.
All this may make speech synthesis seem quite easy. It is, however, a most complicated business requiring specialized electronic hardware and computer software. In one type of synthesis done at Bell Laboratories, the pitch and phrasing of the words and the words themselves are first determined by the analysis of actual human speech. In effect, the speech is coded in condensed form, and certain rules are applied to allow messages to be formed by blending words together. Larry Rabiner's talk, illustrated with figures in the program sheet accompanying this cassette, illustrates these steps.
There are many advantages of using synthetic speech for a computer voice response system. The control parameters can be smooth, quantized, and coded to a low bit rate. Therefore, synthetic speech is efficient in terms of its storage requirements. Secondly, the control parameters from isolated words can be merged together by interpolation, and word duration and pitch inflection can be carefully controlled. Therefore, synthetic speech offers a flexibility in terms of assembling a message-length utterance from single isolated words. We have used these properties of synthetic speech to realize a computer voice response system, which is shown in the first slide.
Turn to figure one in the program sheet accompanying this cassette.
What we first do is take single isolated words and form and analyze them. We put them through an A to D converter and run it through a form and analysis program to give the Forman parameters F1, F2, F3, the first three Formans, the pitch period, AV and AN, the voiced and unvoiced amplitudes, and the fricative pole and zero position for unvoiced sounds. These basic parameters, all of them, are smooth, quantized, and coded to a low bit rate form and stored in a library for use by the AnswerBack program. The AnswerBack program takes a word sequence in as an input and then has rules to combine the individual words together. It generates a timing data, pitch data in one of several manners, combines the form and control parameters from the isolated words by merging and interpolating them to calculate continuous control parameters for the desired message. These control parameters are then put into a digital speech synthesizer, which generates a waveform which is put through a D to A converter and produces the final output speech. We synthesize the speech in this manner. The next slide,
this is figure two,
shows a block diagram of our speech synthesizer, which is essentially the basic element we use for synthesizing the speech. The upper path shows the processing for voice speech. The lower path is for unvoiced speech. The upper path consists of an impulse generator whose pitch period is a function of time, a gain control, and three time-varying resonators along with a fixed fourth or fifth resonator. This gives our voice component. For unvoiced sounds, we have a white noise generator, a gain control, and a variable pole and zero, which give the unvoiced component. These are summed together and put through a fixed spectral compensation network, which represents the glottal source and the radiation impedance characteristics. And the final speech output comes over there. We will first like to demonstrate how we measure the efficiency of the form and control parameters and how we can use this for economy of storage. The next slide.
Please look at figure three.
shows a block diagram of a system we have used to make this measurement. We begin with natural speech, and in this case it's voice speech, and run it through our automatic Forman analysis to give the three formants, the pitch period, and the amplitude of voicing. We then pass the control parameters through variable cutoff frequency low-pass filters, a bank of variable quantizers, and the identical bank of low-pass filters to produce the quantized smooth control parameters, shown by these parameters at this end. To make our perceptive measurement, we ask subjects to state when they could perceive differences between the synthetic speech with various levels of quantization and smoothing and the synthetic speech with no quantization and no smoothing. Using the results of this experiment, we've estimated the overall bit rate for the synthetic speech to be on the order of 600 bits per second, including both voiced and unvoiced speech. We have a demonstration now, a tape demonstration, of the effects of smoothing and quantization on the parameters, the form and control parameters, of the sentence, "We were away a year ago." We'll hear the effect of pitch and form and smoothing on the sentence, pitch quantizing, F1 quantizing, F2 and F3. Each of these effects is done independently. In other words, when we pitch quantize, we don't do any F1 quantizing or anything else, and we'll be able to hear each of these independently.
The first sample illustrates the effect of smoothing in time of the variations in the control parameters which operate the synthesizer. All parameters are first passed through a 16 hertz, then a 12 hertz, then 8, and finally 4 hertz low-pass filter.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
Observe that the parameters themselves do change quite slowly. Each of the control parameters, for example, pitch and formant controls, is analog to digital converted, as they must be to permit economical digital storage of the information. Our starting point for this next series of demonstrations has 7-bit coding of pitch, 4 bits for the first two formants, and 3 bits for the third formant. Recall that 4-bit coding represents only 16 different levels. In this first series, the pitch is quantized to 7, 4, 3, 2, and 1-bit levels, with format quantizing held constant.
We were away a year ago. 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 We were away a year ago.
You notice that the last sample had only 2 different pitch levels corresponding to the 1-bit coding. Now, formant 1 is varied with 4, 3, 2, and 1-bit codings.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
Now the same for formant 2.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
Now formant 3 is encoded with 3, 2, and 1-bit resolution.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
As an overall example, 2 different total encodings are compared, one of which requires 4,600 bits per second, the other 600 bits per second. One of the 4 messages is an original human utterance. Listen, can you identify them?
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
Well, the first and third were the 4,600 bit per second synthesis. The final message was the 600 bit per second form, and the second, that was the human voice. With such a system, one can also obtain some unusual effects simply by manipulating the digital coded data. Here's first the original synthetic message, followed by a 100 hertz monotone pitch form. The third and fourth repeats are obtained by doubling and then squaring the digital data representing each pitch sample.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
Vowels can also be lengthened. Listen to this comparison with 100 millisecond longer E sounds.
We were away a year ago. We were away a year ago.
And the duration of the message can easily be speeded or slowed without changing the pitch patterns.
We were away a year ago. 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 We were away a year ago.
You have come to the end of side one of this issue of IEEE Soundings. To continue, simply stop the machine and turn the cassette to side two.